This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
The two meanings of role-playing.
Ethel Cahoon.
Fantasy film essentials into the 50s.
And badgering John Ruskin.
Well, I sure am glad President Cat greenlit the Catstronauts' mission to expand the International Space Station. I hear he signed the authorization by swatting a pen across the floor. True leadership right there.
Giant laser pointers in space? What's not to like? And even better, the space station has live stream cameras. Although, half the time it's just nose boops. Let's check how the Catstronauts are doing up there on the space station.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Here comes the kitty technician, Blanket. Careful, Waffles. If he catches you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, then it's back to litter box duty for you.
Wait a second, Robin. Major Meowser just got a hair-raising transmission from HQ. Is that the new napping module on its way?
Yep, it's their first space station edition. Science Officer Pom Pom better know what to do, or there'll be a... catastrophe in 3, 2, 1.
Here she is, and she's sharpening her claws on the instruction manual. Well, it might accidentally flip to the right page with enough swiping, I guess.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady with his prodigious belly. Blanket is swatting at the module's fasteners like a feather toy. Pom Pom finally found the right instructions, and Major Meowser is, napping on them? Teamwork, by golly!
Hooray for the Catstronauts!
The space station is saved!
Until the next module arrives and starts another near catastrophe, that is.
Wow, managing your own space station with a crew of feline heroes. Now that's the life!
You know you can, Robin. The official Catstronauts board game is available now from Atlas Games. It's full of pawsome color art by the comic book's creator, Drew Brockington, and Catstronauts features cooperative play that's fun for all ages. Find out more at atlas-games.com/catstronauts.
Sounds like the Catstronauts board game is perfect for the whole family. Let's meet this stellar challenge by picking up the Catstronauts board game now!
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the Gaming Hut, where today in the Gaming Hut, we've got, look at that, Robin, we've got our core books out. Let's see what game we're playing. Let's check these core books. That's the Oxford English Dictionary, the Webster's New International Dictionary, and... I don't even know what that dictionary is. That's some sort of dictionary of theatrical terms and concepts. Well, we'll throw that one out. We don't need it because we're talking about the term role-playing, which besides its meanings in psychology and adult entertainment, it also has two meanings within our art form. First being the act of interacting in character, where you are inhabiting the role of you're a barbarian and you are either responding to stimuli in such a way or even maybe talking to another player who is role-playing, inhabiting their elf. And so interacting in character is role-playing, but also even the most soulless pawn piece, I sacrificed the dwarf to open the dungeon door, role-playing is the name for the form as a whole, the whole art form, everything from the most wonderful and intense freeform borderline LARP to the best graph paper and monsters and dice and ruthless cruelty that you can imagine. All of it is under the rubric of role-playing. And the question, I guess, is, does that cause problems for people talking, for people addressing the art? Does it unnecessarily privilege some portion of the art? Or has it merely named the core of the art form, which is the person playing a role in interaction with the other players? Question mark.
Right. Yeah. So it has these two meanings. These are both very important concepts that we need to communicate. Is that bad that we're using the same word for two very key concepts? And so first of all, it might or might not be bad. We'll decide that in the back half of this segment. But it makes sense that that's how it developed, because role-playing is the thing that distinguishes what we do, what we're talking about in this show, from other sorts of games, and specifically from the war games that it grew out of when Dave Arneson and Gary Gygax and Dave McGarry all had their meeting of the various minds and came up with a game in which, you know, essentially a war game in which the unit was a dude with a hat. And as soon as he had a hat, he had a personality. And as soon as he continued on through multiple adventures, he had a narrative. And before they knew it, they'd created not only a new form of game, but a new form of narrative presentation. And so it makes sense, absolutely, that it's named after the thing that distinguishes it from other sorts of games and its adjacent games. It also makes perfect sense that a art form that was created by people who didn't think they were creating an art form has a sort of paucity of different critical terms that we use to distinguish things, because people were too busy, you know, having skeletons fight thieves and rogues to stop and, you know, have a thought about, you know, laying down all the terminology to make sure that it was all right. So there's certainly other terms that if I got in your time machine and went back to talk to them, I might try and talk them into using other things, notably NPC, which a non-player character, which defines them by what they are not. That's classically a terrible way to define anything. But the issue then is that, unlike passive art forms, unlike, say, movies or theaters, as audience members, we can go to a film or read a book and never have to deal with any critical terms whatsoever. We can just enjoy it for what it is. If we're studying it in class, or, you know, then we can learn all the critical terms, but we don't need them really to enjoy all those things. But in role-playing, we need critical terms because we have to also discuss what it is that we're doing together at the table. And that's how people, whether they're filing playtest reports or talking about something afterwards or setting expectations, that's why we need critical terminology as well as just the technical terminology of things like, you know, the term hit points or the term player characters or what have you. So that's sort of the historical reference. So is this a problem? Are we confused, Ken, by the fact that we use this key term in two quite different ways?
And wildly, just to, you know, touch base on this notion of the first bits of the form, the first versions of Dungeons & Dragons, even the first Boot Hill, were not called role-playing games. The Dungeons & Dragons called itself a fantasy game. Boot Hill calls itself a Western game. The word role-playing doesn't show up as a descriptor of what the game is until Metamorphosis Alpha. And the term itself doesn't really start percolating into what the game is and what we do in it until Holmes Basic. So we have the first, say, 4 years of the art form without even a name for what they're doing, which is the sign, I think, that you've made a really new art form, that you don't even know what to call the thing that you're all doing together.
Right. You don't need a distinguishing term until you've got a product that you're trying to sell.
Right.
It originally wasn't a product. It was a hobby.
Or if this had been a more conventional art form and it had been created by artists within an artistic community, they would have had to come up with a term for the thing they were doing to talk about it with other artists and be snobby. But because it was not that, it formed out of the, you know, as you say, the wargaming hobby, it therefore doesn't need that term because there was no art form to wargaming to compare yourself to. So it's the, you know, one can almost say this is like when they invented theater in ancient Greece and everyone was saying, what is that? And they're like, I don't know, but it's a thing we're doing now. Dionysus likes it. Yeah,
it's walking poetry.
Right.
It's declamation. It's what do we call this?
Right.
Let's call this after the place where we have it.
Right.
Oh, we've now got a thing that has two different terms. Yes.
At least that will never happen again.
Yeah. We'll arrange this differently when we come to it. So I guess so. The question is, has theater imploded because theater has two different key meanings?
I don't think that's what we can put the thumb on the scale of theater having imploded on. I think that it merely got outcompeted by TV, which again, now that we always have to say TTRPG, tabletop role playing, to distinguish our real art form from a bunch of bleeps and bloops on the internet, that's a little bit of the sort of what happened to theater, is that it suddenly had to become live theater or the legitimate stage or a way to distinguish itself from television, which is in many ways identical to theater, and that you sit down at a place and a time and you turn it on and there are people acting out a play. And that is, you know, at the beginning of television, that was very much what theater that was what television was. It was theater just electronically and in a box. This was wargaming just with that extra thing. And they didn't even know what to call the extra thing, as I say, until 78 or so.
Right. And so tabletop RPGs is a example of a retroactive distinguishing from another entertainment form, if not art form. I think everybody who works in video games probably is now arguing that they're an art form, and I'm not going to disargue them.
That they are really, and for true, an art form.
Right. So, once again, the question is, do we always know what we're talking about when we distinguish those two things? Is it essentially context always solves the problem? That we are going to make sure we do a lot of role-playing tonight? There's an example of something where the sentence is unclear. Does it mean that we are going to play for 6 hours and have a tactical game where it's all about checking the rolls and making sure the armor is all right and it's all fighty, fighty, fighty and the personalities don't come in? Or does it mean that we're going to do the opposite of that, that we are going to just have character interaction with each other all night? So there is an example where I don't think you have an equivalent of that in the theater versus theater example, do we?
I mean, I guess that you sort of do if someone says, I'm going to the theater tonight, and someone could say, are you going to go to the movie theater? Are you going to go to the theater to hit on actresses? Are you going to go to the theater to watch a stage play? You have a little of that because, again, you can create an ambiguous sentence. I think that, you know, the wonderful thing about human communication is it's carried out between humans. And if I say to the group, we're going to do a lot of role playing tonight, they may initially parse that as, let's try to play for actually 4 hours instead of spend an hour talking nonsense. But what I think that they will understand is, let's do some personal interaction. This game is going to be a little more intense. We're going to be diving into character responses a little more. And I think that any given game group is probably going to understand, let's do a lot of role playing tonight, as the first, not the second. Now, again, you can always clarify that. Rather than talk about Monty Python or politics for an hour, let's do some role-playing. I think that has the other connotation, that that means we're doing the game that we're here to do instead of the other things that we might be doing when the bunch of us get together and the Doritos come out.
Right. So the answer to that question is context almost always does the work of disambiguation. Mm-hmm. And in the rare instances when it doesn't, you can ask a follow-up question. So this is a non-fatal problem.
I had another problem, which was, does having the same term for both the art form as a whole and a signature activity within the art form, does that inherently privilege some games over others, or at least allow people to say, we're role-playing, y'all are just mucking around with dice, or as the kids love to say on the internet, role-playing, but with two L's. See how funny that isn't? So the notion being that my games are superior because we're doing role-playing, we're interacting in character heavily and deeply and with smoldering glances, you guys are just moving around a dungeon like a bunch of chuds. And I feel like that is actually invidious, but if this distinction did not exist, people would instantly have invented other things to be jerks to each other about, because the art form, as wonderful as it is still practiced by human beings and therefore innately flawed.
Right. And any creation of any critical term will be degraded and used for a bunch of other things until it's meaningless. So nonetheless, I agree 100% that the problem, to the extent that there is a problem with the double meaning, is that it's exactly what you said, that it leads people who like a lot of character interaction to think that that is the core of the hobby, to which other people who want to focus on other parts of the experience need to be coaxed along to. So that if we lived in an alternate universe where the hobby and the sub-activity within the hobby had different names, I think you would get less of that. That people would still, I think, argue that their favorite things are the best things and wonder how to get people at the table to do the thing that they like the most. But I don't think it would have that sense of, this is objectively what we ought to be trying to privilege over other things.
Right. Yeah. If the form had grown up to be called IFGs, interactive fantasy games, you would not necessarily be able to say role-playing is the superior component of IFGs over everything else that goes into IFGs. And
right, because every other sub-activity is interactive in some way.
Yeah. Right? Let me emphasize that as much as I loved the magazine Interactive Fantasy, I am not trying to retroactively replace the name of our art form. That is not how I roll. We're role-playing. During role-playing, we often role-play. I have no problem with that. And I hope that no one else in our beloved audience has a problem with that, because you can't change it if you do. And there's enough things to have a problem with going on in the world at this moment. So there we are.
Well, maybe this is like noticing cigarette burns in a movie, or the fact that in many film sets, the door is twice as large as any door that you would find in nature. Then it's fine until somebody on their stupid podcast points it out to you.
And then it'll drive you crazy forever.
And now you will notice it forever. Well, before people start throwing vegetables at us, Ken, I think it's time for us to head to another segment where no one will have any reason to throw any sort of food product at us at all.
But it's a good thing, because how dare they desecrate the theater, thusly.
Oh, don't you mean the theater?
Oh, yeah, right, the theater.
...1968.
Sinister influences threaten to corrupt America from within and without.
The federal government establishes a new agency for overseas covert action.
The Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, the BNDD.
And within it, the forces of Delta Green.
In the Borealis Connection, the new globe-spanning mega-campaign for the fall of Delta Green, you become the mythos-hunting agents hidden inside the BNDD.
Play 8 linked operations.
As separate standalones.
Or linked into an epic hunt for an infamous target.
Escort a sniper carrying a death warrant for a Shan warlord.
Surveil a Saigon drug summit.
Track heroin couriers on a flight from Hong Kong to L.A.
Investigate the disappearance of an archaeologist working the Bozukepi ceremonial site.
Smash a Beirut drug deal.
ID the actors broadcasting the Necronomicon from a CIA backed Munich radio station.
And wage the drug war amid France's May 68 riots.
Designed by Kenneth Haidt.
Written by Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
The team that brought you the Zelazny Quartet and the Dracula dossier.
The Borealis Connection.
Gorgeously designed and horrifically illustrated by Jen McCleary.
A tale of sordid intrigue.
Cosmic horror.
And desperate action against the mythos.
Now available in Titanic hardback.
From specially cleared gaming retail stores.
And the Pelgrane Press web store.
Now also at the web store as an instantly available PDF-only purchase. The tannoy blaring overhead, the much-thumbed pages of the rough guide in your hand, and the funny, weird foreign currency that you've jammed into your pocket welcome us once more into the travel advisory. But today, the travel advisory is not just seeking out bars and architectural splendor. No, the travel advisory is going indoors, not just because it's hot, but because indoors is where they keep the statues and the paintings that decorate the culture hut. So this dual segment is brought to you by the beloved Robin Laws, who recently returned from London, England, where he saw at the Tate Britain, the good Tate, not the evil Tate, a retrospective of the work of Ithil Kahun, a wonderful artist who people who are not weird occultists should know better and more. And it turns out, Robin, that's what they mean to do, right?
Yes. So this show is at Tate Britain until October 19th. So if you're in London between now and then, I highly recommend this show. It's the first major retrospective given to Ithil Kahun. By the way, it's not spelled Kahun. It's spelled C-O-L-Q-U-H-O-U-N. So that's how you know how to spell it, Kahun. And there's a couple of things going on in the decision to treat her as a major artist. First of all, she clearly is one when you look at her work. She stands on the same sort of stature as others of the Surrealists. And of course, the fact that this canon is still being scoured for work by women. And it turns out when you look for it, you find it. And like a lot of women, Ithil Kahun sort of stepped out of the mainstream contemporary art world and into a sort of a a world of her own, but she never stopped making art. Her art is very interesting and interesting throughout her career. It's not one of those things where, oh yeah, the early period is interesting and then the rest isn't. It's like her whole many decade career is very interesting. Like fellow surrealist Leonora Carrington, she was also adept in multiple forms. She also wrote both fiction, like Carrington, and also some nonfiction books, which we'll get to. So it's unsurprising to see a major museum like the Tate embracing a woman. They're looking for women. But it was surprising to me, though, that the Tate is embracing a woman who was a practicing occultist, that Colquhoun is not in this show being relegated into the category of esoteric art, for example, alongside Austin Osman Spare or other people in that tradition, but she's being treated in this show as a major figure, and a major figure whose occultism is as interesting as her work on the art scene, and that they're inseparable from one another. And I think this is a huge big thing for, you know, serious fancy galleries to be embracing someone who can be discussed here on this show, Ken.
Yeah. Before we get to Ithell specifically, do you have any sense of why this sea change has happened in the art world? Why suddenly we are beginning to get the whole figure of the person rather than some truncated segment of their life through only their paintings or whatever? Or is that too big a question for this?
I think it's just sort of a more culturally ecumenical sense that this is just another interesting tradition that people can be engaged with. So I noticed on several shows that I saw while in London that engaged with is the new curatorial term, which means that it just means that you are interested in something and made it part of your art practice.
Right.
And that I think there's just less fear that perhaps because of historical distance, or in this case, because, you know, she sort of becomes part of the New Age movement and that's a big cultural movement. I think it's just sort of a less of a snobbish concern that her art world credibility has been smattered by something unseemly.
Right.
And so I think it's sort of a loss of snobbery and a search of new, interesting people to explore. And if there's a loss of snobbery at the Tate Britain, I'm all for that.
Yeah, let's do that. Okay. So back, I promised to stop interrupting because she has got a long and wonderful career and you have to tell us all about it in one segment. So knock yourself out.
So she's born in 1906. Even from a very young age, she's one of us. She's a reader of horror and gothic literature. And she goes from 1919 to 1925 to the Cheltenham Ladies College. Mm. And by the time she is there, she is already engaged with the world of the occult and the leptonic, because she writes and designs a play, The Bird of Hermes, which is based on the Ripley scroll. And this is a lost 15th century scroll, but lost in the sense that the original is gone, but there's copies of it. So there's 23 handmade variant copies of this scroll, all of them slightly different, illustrated alchemical works. And they have poems as part of the scroll that reference the alchemist George Ripley, who we should maybe talk about sometime on the pod. At school, she is already plunged into the world of the occult and writing a play about it. She moves on to the Slade School of Fine Art in London, and there she's painting, she's drawn to mythological subjects. So there's one, for example, of Judith showing the head of Holofernes, and it is a striking version of that work. So she's already exploring the world of the grotesque. She's already established herself as having a fine technique. And so she begins to move through the art world, through her schooling, and through the world of life in general. She has relationships with men. But in an unpublished poem, she expresses lesbian yearnings for a woman that she is infatuated with. So that is, of course, very exciting to people who are looking to see people or represent all sorts of different life experiences as well. And she's working in parallel as an occultist and as a painter. So in 1928, she joins the Quest Society, which is later called the Search Society, which is founded by an ex-theosophist named George Robert Stowe Mead. Does that ring a bell for you without being in the research?
G.R.S. Mead is a major, major, major figure in the sort of overlap between dodgy anthropology and theosophy. He, I believe, began as an anthropologist and became a theosophist, but he kept making anthropology. So if you read anything he wrote on, say, the Mazdaeans, you always have to say, how much of this is theosophy and how much of this is real? But he became super influential. The Quest Society, I think, is still one of the major theosophical societies. I believe maybe my copies of Blavatsky are published by them. So, yeah, G.R.S. Mead is a gigantic name, very, very famous, very, very influential. So far, we're not even to 1930, and she's already sparked two more segments, it sounds like. So,
right, yes. So, she tries to join a daughter organization of the Golden Dawn, and she goes for her Golden Dawn interview, and sadly is rejected, or perhaps happily is rejected. She nonetheless gets into Yeatsian occultism, one of the better occultisms to get into as an artist in particular.
Absolutely.
And she visits Paris in 1931, where she is aware of the Surrealists, specifically at this time. She's most impressed by the works of Dalí, who happens to be the group member whose style most resembles hers. So she's already, even before she's exposed to Dalí, she is kind of working in that vein. There's also sort of a bit of a Magritte element to her work, and not in the themes, but in the hard line style and her rendering. And so she comes back from Paris and she reads up on Dalí and she adopts his paranoid critical style to make a new series of paintings, which are basically still lifes or landscapes, which are highly sexually charged. So they're interesting images, but also she is, and of course she's working in England in the 30s and 40s doing, as a woman, doing extremely clearly visual double entendre work. So that's serious rebellion there. And you have to remember that the UK is unaware of surrealism until a few years later, and when it finds out is not too happy about it.
Nope.
So in 36 is when the rest of England becomes aware of surrealism. The famous London International Surrealist Exhibition occurs. She attends that. That's the famous one where Dalí does a performance artwork in an old-timey diving suit and almost dies when he's unable to get out of the helmet. So she meets him there and meets the English people who are bravely trying to establish surrealism in the very hostile environment of the British art scene. In 39, she goes to Paris, where she meets such notable Dreamhands of Paris characters as Man Ray and Paul Eluard. She meets Breton. And she, of course, is a younger than those people, not French. So she sort of bonds with a group of younger, almost sort of second generation surrealists. And they begin to adopt things that Breton and the group explored in the early 20s and then backed away from, frightened. So automatism, for example, and the ritualistic play with magic, which of course is incorporating her other interest, those are all things that Breton backed away from for a while. And in 1940, in the UK, she has the classic surrealist experience of being expelled from the surrealists.
Yes. That you're not a surrealist until you're thrown out of surrealism. That's what I always say.
Exactly, yes. In this case, it's not Breton doing that, but the bargain bin Breton, who lives in the UK and heads the local group, the Belgian poet E.L.T. Mezens. He specifically kicks her out for joining magic societies because you must belong only to the surrealists so that I can feel powerful when I boss you around. And he's also feuding with her soon-to-be husband, Tony Del Renzio, and he kicks out a couple of other people as well. So that's classic surrealism in action, with the officious bureaucrat somehow at the head of the organization about letting loose of limitations and letting your imagination run free. And that's a beautiful irony. So she goes off and immerses herself in various mystical and occult beliefs. So she gets involved in tantric yoga, Kabbalah. She dives back into alchemy. And at this point, she starts visiting Cornwall. And so she gets all into Celtic mysticism, exploring the Celtic connections, and gets into earth energies before they're cool, before people are talking about ley lines. She, one of her major paintings sort of illustrates megalithic sites and the energy running between them. So she's like a secret pioneer of the whole ley line thing. At about this time in 42, Breton, who's headed either in America or headed to America, re-embraces the mythical, but she's already sort of well ahead of that on her own path. After the war in 1947, she divorces Tony Del Renzio, and she leaves the modernist London art set and sort of goes off on her own back to Cornwall. If we want to make her a dreamhound dialing into the dreamlands from Cornwall, in 1947, she makes a gouache drawing called Santa Warna's Wishing Well, with this sort of tentacled structure emerging from the sea. And that's the most overtly Lovecraftian of all of her images. And she might well have actually been familiar with Lovecraft, unlike probably every other surrealist.
Right. Yeah. She might have read him because he's in print in Britain by 1947, certainly.
Yeah.
Just to note real fast, Cornwall, of course, is where Selifaeus, King Kyrenes, has his earthly presence at Trevor Towers. So maybe either you've got a King Kyrenes' earthly self. He's dead by the time she gets to Cornwall, but maybe she follows up on his trail and that's what gets her into the dreamlands. Maybe I should have saved that for the last part, but you were saying Cornwall over and over again, and it drove me crazy.
We can intersperse that. Yes. Let's intersperse. In 1949, she writes an essay called The Mantic Stain, in which she very overtly marries surrealism and mystical practice. To her, they're the same thing. They're two sides of the same coin. And in fact, she becomes more leptonic. In 1950, she starts writing a column called Heaven and Earth in the London Broadsheet. And she's basically becomes their leptonic correspondent. So she reviews a Gerald Gardner book. She discusses UFOs and Donald Kehoe. And she writes book reviews for Prediction, which is a UK sort of equivalent of Fate magazine. In 55, she starts merging mystical writing with travel writing. So she's got The Crying of the Wind, a book that is an illustrated mystical Irish travelogue. And in 57, she writes The Living Stones, which is the same format, but for Cornwall. 61, she goes full on into surrealist fiction. She writes the novel The Goose of Hermogenes, which is all about alchemy and stuff. And finally, in the 60s, she's able to join a Masonic lodge that accepts both men and women. Her archives, which she donated all of her occult stuff to the Tate, I guess anticipating that eventually they would accept it and want to show it.
Yep.
And so the people working on her archive find that her notes are all full of magical diagrams and experiments. And she's chiefly seeking spiritual enlightenment. But in at least one case, they found a spell she was working to find a good chef and driver.
Well, I mean, the servant problem was real by the 60s. So if you have to turn to knowledge and conversation of your holy guardian angel to get a domestic that will stay on the job, that makes as much sense as anything else.
Yeah, there's no shame in a little practical application of magic.
This is also the era where she starts writing essays and things that show up in other, as the Golden Dawn is having its first resurgence, as the New Age takes off. And so this is where I actually ran into her, is as a writer on the topics of the Golden Dawn. I somehow skipped over the surrealist part of her career when I first ran into her. This was decades ago. But her book on the Golden Dawn, Sword of Wisdom, is one that I have read but do not own because it is pricey. So if anyone wants to, you know, make my day, a copy of Ithel Cahoon's Sword of Wisdom would be lovely. But that is definitely where I ran into her, is as a sort of a historian, the sort of perfect inside outside. They were never a member, so they don't have a particular axe to grind, but they were close enough that they're not, that they have a good viewpoint on it and a good knowledge of what's going on. So over and above everything else, she's also a terrific occult historian. And I very much enjoyed reading her writing back when I was doing it.
And, you know, a believer as well as a historian. So she adopts the initiatory name Splendidor Vitro, which means more sparkling than crystal. And she uses it as her signature on her artwork for a while. And she consults Kenneth Grant, of all people, who we talked about in episode 13, the heir to Crowley who incorporates Lovecraft into his belief system. So another opportunity for her to have heard of HBL. He acts as a consultant on the new occult sigil that she uses to sign her work. So sometime in the 70s, she's ordained as a priestess in the Fellowship of Isis. 75 is when she writes the book you mentioned, Sword of Wisdom. And in 77, she makes her own highly abstract, very vividly colored tarot. She only uses one T in tarot at the beginning, and those works were on display as part of the show, and they're very abstract and very beguiling, and I think you'd have to be approaching it in a very specific way to get divinatory information from it. She also illustrates 10 Sephiroth of the Kabbalah at about this time, and she develops a color theory about using color to change your magical consciousness, which she publishes in the Hermetic Journal in the 80s. She's the New Age is no longer nascent by this point. It's like it exists. It's called the New Age. And she's publishing articles in New Age periodicals like the New Celtic Review. She's in with the eco-pagans over at Wood and Water. And she remains an active artist making visual art until she's 77 years old. She spends her final years in a nursing home. She dies in 1988 at age 82. And as mentioned, she donates her occult collection to the Tate and her copyrights to a selection of charities, including the Samaritans, who, among other things, run a suicide helpline, and an anti-noise pollution group, which is very charmingly British, I think.
Yes, especially if she's been living out in Cornwall and getting more and more irritated as she hears cars driving by.
Exactly. There's definitely a whole back to nature thing with what she's doing.
Right. Yeah. So basically, she's one of those people that it is, as you, we've sort of alluded to how we slot her into a Dreamhounds, maybe a Dreamhounds sequel game set after the war, when there was the brief resurgence of surrealism before abstract expressionism clamps down on everything. But we talked about her connection possibly with, you know, she painted Cthulhu or a deep one or something. So she's obviously Cthulhu woke. And what else can she do for us? She's an occultist. So in a standard trail game, or at least an occult artist, she'd make a dandy game master character in a regular trail game where you're in London or Paris or Cornwall, I think, because she's been going out there by then anyway. And so she can be a cool occult artist and maybe a red herring. And maybe she's also just someone who, you know, provides clues by the things that are showing up in her painting, and she doesn't know where they're coming from. And she goes to the most noisily occult of the player characters, of the investigators, and says, you can help me. This horrible presence is showing up in my paintings. And that can be, you know, your hook right there. Is there other things that we can incorporate Ithel Cahoon? Her tarot is not a cheap tarot. I'll say that.
Well, just that her biography is sufficiently long. She's also run and very active in the 60s. So yeah, she can have information from her various studies in basically every branch of the occult and be a sympathetic, trustworthy people for Delta Green agents to talk to or attempt to protect. So, or you could do sort of a diptych thing where there's a trail scenario followed by a Fall of Delta Green scenario in which she figures at different points in her life. And so on that note, I think it's time for us to head on out to another segment and or hut and see what waits for us inside that. In the spiral.
Four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Protect this podcast from alchemical geese by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Tennant Reed,
Dan Simons,
Gray St. Quentin,
Hector Trelane,
and Jay Moore. The whir of the projector, the smell of the popcorn, and the stickiness of the floors under our feet tell us we're once more in the cinema hut. And this time around, our Fantasy Film Essentials series has gotten past 1946 and is going to turn the corner from the 40s.
At great cost to all of us.
Into the 1950s. And we're going to see a bit of a thematic turn. We mentioned earlier that there's a lot of dealing with death and softening of death in the wake of the war. And there's one last title to name on that. And really, I have to assure you, there's other very popular, well-loved ghost comedies that I haven't mentioned, but there's just so many really good ones, and you can't mention a bunch of ghost comedies and then leave out The Ghost and Mrs. Muir from 1947, directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz, a big-time real director with a huge, important filmography, most notably All About Eve. Here, Jean Tierney plays Lucy Muir, who buys a new house and finds out that it is haunted by the salty spirit of the Captain Daniel Gregg, as played by Rex Harrison at his crustiest. And she has to come to terms with the fact that she's got a ghost in her house. He doesn't approve of her suitor, played by George Sanders. So he's both the Ralph Bellamy, but also
that seems like a good choice, frankly.
Yep. Overly suave, untrustworthy suitor. And so it's a mystical, magical rom-com where the obstacle to the couple getting together is that one of them is dead. And it's just extremely well done. It sort of indicates that this theme we were dealing with is beginning to taper off. It spawned a sitcom from 1968 to 70, which was on NBC and later ABC. But as you would expect from Joseph L. Mankiewicz and this cast, including Natalie Wood as a child, you can't knock it. You can't leave it off a list of fantasy essentials. So I put it on our list of fantasy essentials.
And we've also been fielding questions about real religious figures. Well, the realest of all religious figures, Santa Claus, shows up in a lot of movies, but never better than in Miracle on 34th Street, 1947, directed by George Seton. This is a Christmas classic, which I have only mushy childhood memories of. So, Robin, why don't you say why it is a Christmas classic, as opposed to me merely making the bald-faced assertion that it is one?
I still watch this every several years. This is my favorite Christmas movie, in part because it is also a hilarious satirical screwball comedy, as well as being a sentimental story. So Edmund Gwynn plays Kris Kringle, a department store Santa. They use the names of real New York department stores in this. And Maureen O'Hara as the very hard-edged, skeptical person who works at the department store. And she becomes concerned when people start to believe that Edmund Gwynn's Kris Kringle is actually Santa Claus. And there's a concern that he believes that, so he has to be possibly committed. So there's a big court case which involves politics and some delightful satirical back and forth with William Frawley as the cynical New York backroom politician, making sure the judge rules the right way in the case. And it is the first of the films that we've been talking about that really begins to make fantasy and our relationship to fantasy the text of the film, the theme of the film, as well as the sort of underlying part of the genre itself. And it's a theme that we're going to continue to return to again and again, which is people who prefer the world of imagination and belief to people who want to live in a sort of a buttoned-down world of logic. Of course, these films always cheat by suggesting that, of course, the magical thing is correct. But this is still a stone ground classic, extremely entertaining, very funny, and the best Christmas movie ever.
And on the topic of exactly what you just said, making the question of fantasy the text instead of the subtext, and the kindred question of, wouldn't you rather live in a world with a giant invisible rabbit than not? We get to Harvey, 1950, directed by Henry Koster. Maybe not James Stewart's best role ever as Elwood P. Dowd, or Dowd Elwood P., as he says throughout the film, but in running for one of his best roles ever.
It's his most Jimmy Stewartish role, if not his best role.
Right. If when you think of Elwood P. Dowd and you put him into the Michael Mann westerns that he was in, it's quite the whiplash and a testament to his range as an actor, but he personifies sweetness in a way in this movie that I don't think any actor has ever gotten within a mile of. The story is that Elwood P. Dowd, area character, has a giant invisible rabbit, his friend Harvey, who he basically likes better than most people, but he does have some cronies that he hangs out with at the area bar. And his sister, Vita, Josephine Hull, in a terrific performance because she has to pretend to be mad at Jimmy Stewart, which is impossible, is both mad at him for embarrassing her and also worried that he's maybe gone around the bend. Psychiatry as the enemy is another thing that is beginning to crop up in these films, which is, I think, a very interesting subtext to start bubbling up. We saw psychiatry as sort of neutral in horror films of the 30s, then there's sort of a turn and it becomes just a straight up threat to everything decent. And in fantasy, it's also a threat to the world of magic and wonder, which I suppose technically it is if you're a fun ruiner and a hater. But anyway, fundamentally, we have it's not, I don't think, fast paced enough to be screwball, but it's sort of a things begin to build and the presence or absence of Harvey becomes a bigger and bigger question and people are wrongly committed and rightly committed and a whole situation arises. And at the end of the day, everyone basically has become better because of this wonderful invisible rabbit that is in their life. I believe Jimmy Stewart, in fact, just straight up says it's a pooka, an Irish shape-changing spirit. But he doesn't shape change. He stays an invisible rabbit the whole time.
Yeah, it's a really early example of introducing a mystical being where the characters look him up in a reference book right. And provide you all of the lore. It's very explicitly that.
Yeah, that's maybe a drift over from horror where people were looking up vampires and werewolves all the time. And now we're looking up pookas and finding out that they're mostly harmless, as the encyclopedia would say. But anyway,
yep.
It's a fantastically sweet film, maybe out of tune with how everyone feels normally, but all the more reason to watch Harvey. It's pure magic and has never been bettered, I think, in that sort of wouldn't we all rather be in a better world type question without necessarily literally going to Narnia or wherever.
Right. It's based on a 1944 play by Mary Chase, and the play, unlike a lot of plays that movies from this period are based on, is still highly performable today. It still plays and is mostly the movie is in the play, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of Christmas movies, can't not mention A Christmas Carol in the UK. It's a point of origin. It was called Scrooge. This is the 1951 one directed by Brian Desmond Hirst. It's the one with Alistair Sim. If you don't know A Christmas Carol or don't know that this is the best straight up version of Christmas Carol, it is. Let's just leave it at that. Do we need to explain anything more of why the best version of A Christmas Carol belongs in a Fantasy Essentials series?
I mean, yeah, no, I think that is undeniable. And you're just going to get pushback from fans of Bill Murray and George C. Scott. Both of them have great strengths to them. And I guess from the Muppets. But the best Christmas Carol is, in fact, the Britishest Christmas Carol, because that's how Christmas carols work. And Alistair Sim is great. And again, this is possibly the best fantasy novella ever written. So why are we even defending this? Frankly, I feel like is the question to be asked. But again, this is sort of the flip side, I guess, if we're trying to tie it in. This is if you live a life that is too buttoned down, too concerned with money and quotidian things, you basically lose not just fantasy, but you lose human connection of all kinds. And so this is, in another way, it's arguing for the importance of not just the fantastic, but the immaterial, meaning love and religion, in everybody's life. And that's the message of A Christmas Carol. It was apparently desperately needed, thought Dickens, back in the Victorian times. And in 1951, people felt, maybe they didn't get the point the last 90 times we've done The Christmas Carol. Let's do it this time and nail it down.
And next, Ken, Michael Powell gets on the list for a third time with the Tales of Hoffman. I love this movie, but you've just seen this movie, so tell us about it.
Yeah, not just you, Robin. Martin Scorsese and George Romero both have it on their top movies of all time.
So do you know the rest of that story?
No, I don't know the rest of that story. Oh, I know. I tell the rest of the story. I just realized I do, but it's funnier if you do it.
So back in the day, a young George Romero would periodically rent a 16mm print of Tales of Hoffman and watch it over and over and over obsessively as a young cineast. He'd order it from the distributor in New York. But about half the time he wanted it, there'd be some other guy who had rented it instead of him. And he was like, why? I'm the only one who loves this movie. Why is someone else renting this movie all the time. And decades later, he finds out that the other guy who has the Tales of Hoffman print the other half of the time is Scorsese.
So with that appeal to authority out of the way, let me just say that it is a film of the opera, Tales of Hoffman, or I guess technically the operetta by Offenbach. This is an Englished version of the French original, and Offenbach is basing his opera on, guess what, Tales of E.T.A. Hoffman. Hoffman wrote horror, and he wrote sort of fantasy with a sting in it, and this is the fantasies with a sting in it. This is the specific Hoffman stories, The Sandman, Counselor Crespel, and The Lost Reflection, and the movie moves them a little bit out of order from the opera, which is all well and good. And it takes a bit of getting used to, as watching opera always does, unless you're a thoroughly experienced operatist. But once you fall into it, you can't get out of it, and you don't want to get out of it, because it is sheerly beautiful. And because it is Powell and Pressburger making this movie, they have done for opera everything that the actual work of opera cannot do. So you can do transitions between scenes, you can do special effects, you can do quick change costumes, you can do all manner of, you know, tricks with makeup and whatnot that you just can't do on stage. So in a way, Tales of Hoffman may be the best way to see the opera, although obviously if you get a chance, you should go see it anyway because culture. But Robert Rounceville plays Hoffman. He's one of the only actors who sings his own part. The other actors are all lip-syncing. The woman Antonia from the last segment is also singing her own part. And he is consumed by the love of Stella, who is a ballerina. Her message to him goes awry, and so he goes to the local tavern to drink his troubles away and tell stories of how every other love of his life has turned out terrible. And the chorus is all encouraging him. There's a wonderful bunch of crane shots and tracking shots. And it's very not unlike any time in the bar where you're telling stories while also being a stilted and artistic opera presentation. The fact that naturalism comes through is, I think, tribute to Powell and Pressburger. But he tells the story of how he, as a young man, fell in love with an automaton, also played by Maura Shearer, as is the ballerina. But it turns out that an evil automaton builder and an even eviler maker of fake magical glasses, or real magical glasses, they exist to fake stuff up, fooled him, and then cycles into a story of him in Venice falling in love with a prostitute named Giulietta. That has the most famous chorus in the whole opera in that segment, opening it up. So all of you Gilligan's Island stands will remember that bit as we go in. But Giulietta turns out to be in service to a necromancer, a magician, who traffics in reflections and wants Hoffman's reflection. And so she steals his reflection, and then there's a magic duel. It's terrific at the end, but she goes off with the necromancer and Hoffman is left alone. Finally, he's met a wonderful singer, Antonia, but she suffers from a disease that if she keeps singing, she will die. But guess what? The bad guy, Dr. Miracle, who Sheila came downstairs when I was watching and said, "Why is a vampire singing?" And I said, "Well, that's how Dr. Miracle rolls." And it turns out Dr. Miracle is also played by the same actor, Robert Helpman, who has played the bad guy in all these, Dapertuto, the necromancer, Coppelius, the maker of fake spectacles, and Lindorf, his rival for the love of the fair Stella. And at the end of the play, which is actually kind of meaner than the end of the opera, he's just passed out drunk, and Stella goes off with Counselor Lindorf, the bad guy, and that's the end. Everyone enjoy your life. But it's watching that, first of all, the sheer visceral color, spectacle, sound, beauty of the film, nonpareil. But also, it made me think what a weird monoculture fantasy has turned into. That it's a situation where we've talked about the pears, all the good pears have basically been boiled down to like four varieties of pears. There used to be fantasies where people would steal reflections and weird vampire doctors would come around and there'd be automatons and whatnot. But now all of those are hothouse creations, barely available, and we just have the good old Bartlett pair of swords and dragons. And nothing against a Bartlett pair, nothing against swords and dragons, but the ecology over and above, oh, let's shoot an opera and release it as a major motion picture. But the ecology of fantasy that this is presenting, and 51 is just about where we're just about to leave that wonderful sunny upland and go into the dragon haunted crags. And that'll probably make the turn in the next decade, right?
Yeah. So everything you said is absolutely correct. And it's one of those films where you're watching it entranced, asking yourself, why is this so magical? Why is this like incredibly improbable thing, like a film of a Offenbach operetta? Why does this work so incredibly well? And one answer is it's Michael Powell.
Yeah.
But what that means, what exactly Michael Powell is doing in film after film after film, including this one, to create that sense of magic, that very cinematic fusion of all of these things, it's hard to answer. So that's why you would keep renting it again and again if you're Romero,
George Romero
or Scorsese. I originally saw this at the Toronto Film Festival when they used to have a series of where they would bring in illustrious guests to pick an archival film and introduce it. So when I saw The Tales of Hoffman, I saw it introduced by George Romero, which was an extra little treat. So it's been described as the best opera film of all time. There's another contender, which we'll discuss later, which is also a fantasy film. But for the moment, it's time for us to exit the cinema hut. And it's hard to believe, but we still have another segment left. So let's get to that as quickly as we can. The British are coming! The British are coming!
In Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons, you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The new campaign guide, The American Crisis, War in the North, covers the early actions of the war with historical adventures, setting information, and a fiendish Hessian plot.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
Educators can get a copy of the core book for use in the classroom absolutely free.
The American Crisis is currently released as a PDF with physical pre-orders available.
Visit nationsandcannons.com to check out a free adventure chapter and the quick start guide.
The whirring of time gears and the clacking of chronotons tell us we're once more standing in proximity to Ken's time machine, which is the conveyance that, of course, Ken's superiors at Time Incorporated used to send him back into history to bend, fold, spindle, and sometimes, yes, even mutilate it. And Ken, many times, Time Incorporated will send you on very important missions where you can save thousands or even millions of lives, where you can protect important works of art, where you can bring things back from the dead of history. But this is your most important mission ever, which is to eliminate an annoyance that I personally feel about this very central, we've Ouroborosed it, people. We're back to the issue of critical terminology, because there is a storytelling concept that is absolutely bedrock, obvious, simple thing that you have to explain to people. I was recently reminded of how annoyed by what the actual term for it is while writing about it in the upcoming Hamlet's GM screen book. And that term is pathetic fallacy, which describes, at least these days, a very elemental thing in storytelling, but which is neither to our modern ears pathetic or fallacious.
Right.
So I want you to go back, visit John Ruskin, the pioneering critic responsible for this term, which granted has drifted somewhat since he invented it. And I need you to talk him into a term that will make more sense to people immediately when I write about it in Hamlet's GM screen. So Ken, I guess you're going to have to explain a little about the fellow you're going to visit, John Ruskin.
Yeah, John Ruskin, really fast, because he is one of those Victorians who is so eminent that he's in a million categories. But we're going to try and treat it fast. He's born in 1819. His father is a wealthy wine merchant, basically hard work and probity and all the good things. He's got an evangelical mother who reads him the Bible over and over and makes sure that he hits the metric feet of the Psalms. So she instills in him the importance of aesthetic correctness. He's at Oxford from 1836 to 1842. His aesthetic sense has been formed by visits to the stately homes of England, looking at their art collection, their architecture, and then by travel in Europe. In 1837, he writes The Poetry of Architecture. This is a minor work at the time, later becomes very big. It influences Frank Lloyd Wright as well as many other architects, where he says buildings must grow out of their natural setting. They must use local materials and reflect the local environment, both socially and biologically. And so that becomes, you know, the seabed of modern architecture in its good sense, not the bad sense. He then, his first major publication is Modern Painters, Volume 1, publishes that in 1843 anonymously by a graduate of Oxford. He's defending J.M.W. Turner, which means Ruskin and I are on the same side here, though not everywhere. And he is defending Turner against the sort of stylized, the symbolic, the academy art. He says, Turner paints actual things, not things that he thinks of and then paints. Turner's out in the landscape getting it done. Turner is the real art. Real art is about truth. Real art is about actual objective things. And this is where this is going to feed into pathetic fallacy.
Right. Not that we have time for a digression, but there is a hilarious digression. If you go upstairs from the F.L. Calhoun exhibit into the Tate and go to the Turner rooms, because there's an entire room devoted to later dumb things that Ruskin said about Turner. So it's important to keep that in the context of the fact that he was largely and initially a defender of Turner.
Yeah. So anyway, he does the seven lamps of architecture. This is an argument that the seven lamps of architecture are the seven virtues. That's maybe not a great piece of architecture, but it's a very interesting piece of cultural criticism. And it begins to create what was later called the Ruskin Gothic. The notion that you could build a Gothic train station and it would still be virtuous and good, even though it's not a cathedral. He then writes The Stones of Venice after going to Venice and being sad that all the buildings are falling down. This begins the architectural preservation as opposed to restoration movement. This is a big thing that'll set off landmines 100 years from then. He hangs out with the Pre-Raphaelites, his wife Effie, who is vastly maltreated. This is where you stop rooting for John Ruskin if you're reading his biography. She leaves him for John Everett Millais, the painter, in 1853 and 1854. This does not sour him on the Pre-Raphaelites in general. He provides a handsome stipend to Elizabeth Siddle, for example, from episode 456, to allow her to create art, because his theory is all artists should create art honestly and happily, which means they shouldn't have to worry about where their rent check is coming from, which as a writer, I can't disagree, but I don't think it's a practicable social goal, which is where I disagree with literally everything else Ruskin writes. Ruskin in 1856 is working in the third volume of his series, Modern Painters. And of course, it's mostly about poetry because this is something, I guess, where the book is so good. The title is so strong, but it's not, we're not going to talk about painting anymore. We're talking about everything else. And
classic bait and switch. Sell me painters, give me poets.
Right, exactly. Called On the Pathetic Fallacy. And he's presents the pathetic fallacy, which is the difference between the ordinary, proper, and true appearances of things to us and the extraordinary or false appearances when we are under the influence of emotion or of contemplative fantasy. And he says, for example, you've got a poem by Alton Locke. They rowed her in across the rolling foam, the cruel crawling foam. The foam is not cruel, neither does it crawl. The state of mind which attributes to it these characters of a living creature is one in which the reason is unhinged by grief. All violent feelings have the same effect. They produce in us a falseness in all our impressions of external things, which I would generally characterize as the pathetic fallacy. And he distinguishes that from just make-em-ups, which he calls willful fallacy and won't even talk about. He's so mad at it. And that's where you like you give emotions to a crocus for no reason, except you just want to do it. So he's just mad at the whole pastoral genre, I guess. But he's super mad that he likes poems of pathetic fallacy and has to go out and say, poets of the first rank, like Homer and Shakespeare, don't do the pathetic fallacy because they're strong and cool. Poets of the second rank, Wordsworth, looking at you, will do the pathetic fallacy, and even though you enjoy it. So for him, pathetic means pathos, of strong emotion. Fallacy doesn't mean logical fallacy. It just means falsehood. So falseness under the influence of strong emotion is pathetic fallacy. So it's a swipe against the Romantics and the reflective poets. Remember, he didn't like the reflective artists as against Turner. He doesn't like reflective poets like Wordsworth, who saw some daffodils, but doesn't write down what he thought about the daffodils then. He sits and he thinks about the daffodils, so he writes about a mental image of daffodils, which are wrong. And so he says, the Romantics are the men who feel strongly, think weakly, and see untruly. And then he also is arguing against beauty for beauty's sake, which he sees as the thing the Renaissance did. Without a moral grounding, a grounding in truth, you're just doing a bunch of empty nonsense.
Right. Now, the problem comes from the fact that this very specific weird idiosyncratic term that he invented rapidly becomes the term for describing things in the environment in a way that mirrors the emotions of the characters, which is a key technique of any narrative storytelling. And of course, is used both by the people that Ruskin likes and the people that he dislikes, including Shakespeare and Homer. So I need a better term, perhaps emotional mirroring, but you know, you can workshop that. So Ken, how do you make sure that this awkward, abstruse term does not come down to us as the term for this incredibly key concept?
Okay. Before I get to the method, and believe me, the method is maybe not one you're going to like. I'm certain that Time Incorporated is not going to like it. Worse yet, people now misuse the term pathetic fallacy, even. They say that the pathetic fallacy is now only referring to imputing human emotions to things, and that's different than personification, which is any human quality to things. That's not true. It's not even all of personification.
Right. Well, people generally tend to mix up critical terms, but they're going to do it more with a critical term that is weird in the first place.
Right.
So Ken, I'm willing to loosen the ethical boundaries on this one. How do you do it?
How do I do it? Well, the problem is Ruskin is not a big drinker. His dad is a wine merchant. He's grown up drinking wine his whole life, but very early on, he realizes that if you're drunk, you're not seeing things truly. So he is always against getting drunk. I cannot use the strongest weapon in my quiver. Also, arguing Ruskin out of language is going to be a hard, an uphill climb. If you've ever read Ruskin, you know that the sort of the quality of the language is one of the great things about reading Ruskin. Even when he's talking utter nonsense, you get carried away by the sweep and the power and the specificity of his language. So it's very beautiful and very cool.
I didn't say this was easy. I said it was necessary.
Right. So here's what I'm going to have to do. I'm going to have to show up, Hawaiian shirt, jeans, the whole nine yards, and say, hey, John Ruskin, I'm here from the future. In the future, people are still talking about the pathetic fallacy. That term that you invented is still big. People cannot get enough of it. Also, they're all getting it wrong. They're saying it wrong. They're getting it confused with other things. They're using it to mean things it doesn't mean. You would not believe how stupid people in the future are. Also, the words pathetic and fallacy lose the meaning you're using in about 80 years. Just throwing that out there. He's never going to go for emotional mirroring. He would stab me in the hand with his pen.
Right. By the way, the Tate Britain says that you didn't like Turner.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So what's that about? But he would stab me in the hand with emotional mirroring. He's going to come up with some other term, but we will work together to hopefully to make sure that it does not lose its clear meaning in his lifetime, which it basically does. Also, I will be armed with the poet Anthony Hecht, who did possibly the best reasoned demolition of Ruskin in a lecture to the Library of Congress in 1984 called The Pathetic Fallacy. You can find it online. He begins by pointing out, oh, that's weird. Homer doesn't use the pathetic fallacy. Why are all those spears thirsty for blood all through Homer? Interesting question. Wouldn't know.
Yes, that is an obvious, bold claim.
Hecht is not being mean to Ruskin, but he does attack Ruskin both on his weak points and on his strong points, which is what I think makes it the best demolition. So I will be armored with Anthony Hecht's arguments if it gets down to that. I'm hoping that just saying in the future, people are super excited to talk about your idea. They just all get it wrong because of the words you use is going to be enough to get him to come up with different words. I cannot at all promise that emotional mirroring will be what he says, because I'm sure that won't be. But
you're free to workshop it. Just can't be pathetic fallacy.
Not be pathetic fallacy. And I will be workshopping it with one of the best writers of the Victorian era, an era not short of good writers. So I feel like between me and John Ruskin over a decorous glass or two of sherry in between me declaiming Homer, we can maybe see our way clear to changing that chapter to a different one. But this is going to be tougher than, you know, 90% of my other time assignments, because out arguing John Ruskin is something that broke, you know, plenty of Oxford graduates in the day, and maybe at the limit of my powers, even with a ringer in my pocket.
Right. And in general, very obstinate people do not become less obstinate when they're drunk. So even if he was a drinker, that wouldn't necessarily help. So at the end of the Ken's Time Machine, we usually look for gaming applications of what we've talked about. And this time around, an annoying obligatory paragraph in Hamlet's GM screen would be unnecessary. That's our show, folks. Come back next week. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/canandrobin.
Stop sad rain from falling on this podcast by joining such backers as
Theron Bretz,
Lewis R. Evans,
Pedro Garcia,
Kevin H.,
and Toonspew.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Grab our latest design, Subtlety is for People Who Forgot Their Battering Ram.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.